We are facing this as a people. Whether we live in Israel, Australia, Canada, we are facing this as a people. The understanding that united, and that's not uniformity, but united on this, on these issues, on actually utilizing the IHRA working definition to say anti-Zionism is the modern strain of anti-Semitism. It's not enough that you tell me you're committed to protecting Jewish life in New York City or Montreal or Berlin if you don't recognize anti-Zionism, that is, the systematic demonization, delegitimization, and application of double standards to the state of Israel as Jew among nations, then you are not committed to combating anti-Semitism in any of those spaces.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Mahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international standing and alliances. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise and the slogans and the shallow discourse to bring you fresh insights onto the most critical developments happening in Israel and the Middle East.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East and Israel. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
We read your comments and questions, so please keep sending them. Lav, we're recording this week on the second day of Hanukkah. Tonight we're going to light the third candle. It's, you know, a beautiful holiday of light. Obviously, it's also been a holiday of tragedy following the devastating terror attack in Sydney. And before we discuss that, I just want to say one thing that reminded me of the Abraham Accords. I just went into the bakery next to our offices.
I have to tell you, it's amazing bakery. You know, I mostly work from home. I don't come into the office that much, but whenever I do, I cannot resist the temptation. But anyway, go ahead.
It's this amazing French bakery. But so, and on Hanukkah, we eat sufganiyot, which are these fried donuts, which are very, very, certainly in Israel, elaborate toppings. And I walk in and they have the Dubai sufganiyah, which has like pistachio and other things, but I don't think before the Abraham Accords you would have had a Dubai sufganiyah. So it's a great mix of, I think, the Abraham Accords and Jewish Israeli culture.
Yes, there's Dubai chocolate everything now. It's really interesting. But unfortunate note, I think we have to talk about the attack on Bondi Beach in Sydney. I don't know if you've been. I've been there for to speak in the past, and it's on the one hand, it's like maybe the most popular beach in Sydney. It's really beautiful, and it's an area where there's a lot of tourists, but also a lot of locals who just hang out, go to the beach. And on the other hand, just a couple blocks away is like the major Jewish community of Sydney. Like I spoke at a synagogue and at a B'nai Akiva that were like maybe a 10-minute walk from the beach. So I knew exactly where the attack took place. And of course, it was two terrorists shooting at a candle lighting that was hosted by Chabad. They were a father and son. The father had previously been investigated for ties to the Islamic State. 15 victims killed and more than 40
10-year-old
injured.
A 10-year-old girl, a Holocaust survivor. I mean, it's
and the Chabad shaliach to the community. And among those injured is our friend and colleague, another Misgav fellow, Arsen Ostrovsky, who a bullet grazed him in the head. Probably those who are listening have seen photos of him online. While we're speaking, he's still recovering in the hospital. We want to wish him a speedy recovery. And for those who are inclined to, should pray for Yecheskel Ben Zoya for health.
Absolutely. And Arsen is one of the toughest fighters for Israel online and on the international stage. And this is just going to, I think, strengthen his resolve and all of our resolves to fight back against this wave of anti-Semitism, of violence against Jewish communities around the world. I'll give a shout out to my sister, Sarah Fredman Ader, who just published an article in E-Jewish Philanthropy about the importance of putting the Chanukiah, the Chanukah candles in the window and being proud and open about showing Jewish symbols, whether it's a blow up Chanukiah on the front lawn, but also more traditionally, the lights in the window. And, you know, it's hard to make any judgments about people who are concerned about their security, their family security. We saw the shooting in California at a Jewish home with Hanukkah lights. But I do think that her recommendation, and I believe this very strongly, that it is critically important that Jewish people around the world proudly display their Hanukkah lights, which remind us of the miracle of Hanukkah, wherever they are.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to my daughter last night. She's almost 9 years old. She overheard me on a Zoom call. I was interviewing a former hostage, and she was remembering the hostages, and she was really upset. And I said, you know, I'm glad we're having this conversation on Hanukkah, because, you know, Hanukkah was a time that it reminds us that the things that the Maccabim were fighting for then are the things that we're fighting for today, that the IDF is fighting for today, you know, that we want to be a free Jewish people. We want to have a place where we are safe to be ourselves, to practice our religion, and to live as a nation and as a free people in our sovereign land. And on that note, I think that for those of you who noticed that Asher was only sporadically part of the podcast in the past, what has it been, 2 months, 6 weeks? He is one of those IDF soldiers who's been fighting for us. He's been in reserve duty, and I know you wanted to tell us a little bit about that.
There's just something that reminded me, like you said, about Hanukkah. In my reserve unit, we have people from every walk of life, doctors and high-tech workers and teachers and security guards, really from every background, religious, non-religious, all parts of the country, every ethnic background, people ranging from the ages of 23 to 50. And when they get called up for reserve duty, they just drop everything. They come, this is their sixth round of reserve duty since October 7th, and we had more than the regular number of people showing up for reserve duty. And you know, you go out at nighttime and in the rain, in the dark, and when you hear gunshots, these people that nobody's going back, they're going forward and dedicated to the mission. And I think that's just an incredible, when you look at the people of Israel, Am Yisrael, their ability to, the resilience, the courage, the strength. And it's not easy. I mean, it's physically difficult, mentally difficult. I do think that's something that's very empowering. I don't think there's a lot of other nations of peoples where, just again, the most ordinary people, the people that you interact with every single day, drop everything and carry out these real acts of heroism. And it does remind me, you know, like everybody, spend time online and follow the podcast world. And I do think we have to care about what the anti-Israel podcasters are saying, because it does impact public opinion in the U.S. and on the conservative spectrum. But when I do compare these sort of, you know, I would call them pampered, polished podcasters sitting behind their microphones spewing anti-Israel theories or claims, and then you see the real courage and strength and resilience and power of the people in Israel dedicated to defending themselves, I find that inspiring and you know, gives me confidence and confidence in our future.
Yeah, I think that's a great message. I think Israelis, at least when it comes to these kinds of things, have their sort of heads on straight. They know what's important, especially those who have been in Miluim or have relatives in Miluim.
And your husband who's done hundreds of days of Miluim.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I think that there is a balance, because I think we can't just dismiss the Tucker Carlsons and Candace Owens of the world, because unfortunately they do impact a lot of people. They do have an influence on public opinion. Tucker himself is you know, a close friend of Vice President J.D. Vance and an influence on President Trump and other people in his orbit. And so, you know, a lot of it is a question of proportion. With some of these people, sometimes I wonder if the initial, like, very upset, very major response to things they said that maybe were a little borderline anti-Semitic, like, maybe that pushed them into a more sort of defiant stance that made it worse. And so I think like we do have to think about what the balance is and to make sure that we're responding in a way that's not counterproductive. But on the other hand, I think in Israel, we can feel sometimes like, you know, we have our war and this is a real war and it's important. And we have to realize that our brothers and sisters of the diaspora are fighting their own kind of war. It's another front in this war, as our guest, Michal Cutler, one who we'll hear from soon, talks about, and that their war is also very serious. And as we saw this week, also very deadly.
Absolutely. And then they're showing for the student who stands up on a college campus and waves an Israeli flag, or even, as I said before, the Jewish family in a community in London or New York or Sydney or Paris who puts their Hanukkah in their window proudly, that takes also real courage and sadly is an actual risk. I did want to tell one anecdote from my recent reserve duty in Gaza. We were in a counter-terror operation, and we entered the house of a Hamas terrorist, and we found what you'd expect. We found his Hamas uniform. We found Hamas instruction booklets, how to build bombs, how to carry out attacks. We found all kinds of Hamas paraphernalia. And then lying next to all of that on the bed were pillows stolen from Israel's Sheba Hospital, which also treats many patients from Gaza. So what that means is that this Hamas terrorist who was involved in planning and carrying out the October 7th attack, he or his family members had gone to Israel for medical treatment. Israel had treated them, and then they stole the pillow and brought it back to Gaza. And, you know, that's the people that we're dealing with.
It's our shared humanity, something that Israelis and Gazans have in common. Yeah, keep going.
No, I think it's a good thing that Israel is treating people from Gaza who need treatment. I just, you know, to imagine the kind of person who could be treated,
I was
be
joking
saved.
People who like steal pillows and towels and things. But anyway, yeah.
It's true. Israelis abroad also have. But there's somebody who could get treatment by an Israeli doctor, and then the next day turn around and carry out the most heinous terror attack against those same people who saved him or one of his family members. That's the kind of enemy that we're facing and that we continue to face.
Yeah, those kinds of things are infuriating. And it reminds me of a report that I read a few days ago that I was unfortunately not able to confirm or get a solid denial for it. There's not a lot of clarity around it, but that the Trump administration is asking Israel to foot the bill for clearing the rubble from Gaza, which is a very hefty bill, right? Probably billions of dollars. And to me, it's like, you know, the classic definition of chutzpah is like if someone murders his parents and then he throws himself at the mercy of the court because he's an orphan. And that's like, you know, Gaza, like the leadership of Gaza, Hamas, and we also know many of the civilians supported it, came in and massacred Israelis and people visiting Israel on October 7th. And now they cry and they want Israel to pay to clean up the damage from the war that they started. Like, why should we pay that? It's just an outrage. And so it's the same kind of thing where, like, if Israel doesn't provide medical treatment to Palestinians, then you see them crying about how bad Israel is. And then Israel does provide treatment, and those same people who, you know, are walking or are healthy or whatever, thanks to Israel, then go off to kill Israelis. It's no good deed goes unpunished.
It is infuriating. I think the chances that Israel will actually pay for taking out the rubble, I think, are very, very low. I can't see any Israeli leader, politician agreeing to something like that. Though, again, I don't know what's happening in the inner conversations between the Trump administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu. I will say one thing from a strategic perspective, and people might not be familiar, about when you're in north or central Gaza, about a kilometer into Gaza, there's what's known as the 70 Ridge or the 70 Hills, which is a ridge, the highest point in Gaza. I think it's called the 7 because I think it's 70 meters above sea level. Remember, we're at a coast, so it's a very sort of flat area. And right now, Israel is sitting on top of this Ridge 70. And whoever's on top of Ridge 70 can basically overlooks and, in a sense, controls from a military perspective and from a visual perspective, both from there to the border with Israel and all the communities on the border, and on the other side towards the ocean.
So basically all of Gaza.
All of North and Central Gaza. And we know for a fact that there are still many Hamas tunnels under that area, and Hamas launched its attack from that ridge and carried out a lot of the intelligence gathering from that ridge. And in my view, Israel needs to stay there, bottom line. That Israel's security preventing another October 7th requires Israel to be present on that ridge. And if, God forbid, Hamas or Hamas de facto, because you have some sort of international, international troops like UNIFIL, right, who are present but don't actually prevent Hamas from doing that, if there are once again terrorists on that ridge, then their ability to carry out the next devastating terror attack goes way up. And really, the very basic security of Israel, of the communities in the Gaza envelope, in the Western Negev, requires Israel to maintain presence on that key strategic area.
So outside of Israel and the Trump administration, when people talk about it, they think like they talk as if Israel's going to withdraw from all of Gaza. But in reality, what the Trump plan says and what Israeli leaders say is that Israel is going to maintain a wider buffer zone than it did before. So if it's about a kilometer in, then in theory, we are supposed to stay on that ridge. So that's good news.
Mm-hmm.
In practice, the ceasefire plan seems to be slowly falling apart. So I guess we're going to have to hope that it's stays in that respect, also that it continues because we need to disarm and demilitarize. But we have a lot to talk about with our guest who's coming on now. We have Michal Kotler-Wunsch, the CEO of the International Legal Forum, which is a hub for lawyers who act to support Israel. She was previously Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism and a Knesset member for the Blue and White Party.
Michal Kotler-Wunsch, it's a pleasure to have you on the Miskav Mideast Horizons podcast. Obviously, we wish it were in different circumstances. We're recording on Tuesday, December 16th, 2 days after the devastating terror attack in Sydney, Australia. One of our senior fellows here at the Miskav Institute, Arsen Ostrovsky, himself was injured in that terror attack and remains in the hospital. And we're obviously continuing to pray for all of the victims of the attack who are still undergoing treatment or being hospitalized, and we're thinking about the families of those who were murdered. Michal, there's been condemnation, some more forceful, some less, some mentioning the fact that there was an anti-Semitic attack, some that somehow forgot to mention that fact. But I wanted to ask you, as Israel's former special envoy for combating anti-Semitism and a real expert on this topic, what are effective steps, measures that countries, governments, social society institutions, whether it's countries around the world, whether it's Israel itself, can and should take to actually combat anti-Semitism?
So the first thing, and I actually want to begin, of course, my predecessor in my current role as CEO of the International Legal Forum, Arsen Ostrovsky, and obviously extend complete and quick recovery to him and to all of those who were injured, and of course, condolences to the many families, and I'll say to the general community, having many, many family members that were both present and live in Australia and are in shock, are traumatized, are grieving, are in many ways coping with what sometimes we as Israelis think of as something that's accessible to us, but are coping with making this accessible to their own children, young children, older children. There were thousands of people at that beach. So we begin there in that moment of grief on what is supposed to be a celebration of light on Hanukkah. And from there, I'll continue directly to your very important question, Usher, because look, for the better part of the 2+ years that I served as Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, appointed to the role only 3 weeks before October the 7th, I traveled around the world, including in a hearing in the UN that I called Never Again Is Now, 1 month after October the 7th, precisely to sound the alarms for what is coming, for what had to be not only predicted, but could have been prevented. And as you may recall, I described the October 7th massacre, the war crimes, the crimes against humanity, as the Kristallnacht moment of our times. I did so in the UN, but the understanding at the time was how the world would respond to the Kristallnacht moment of our times would actually differentiate the various countries, institutions, governments, leaders of all kinds, political, religious, and you know, as I say, of all kinds, that would differentiate the coping that should have been expected, which was what we ultimately saw, the unleashing, a tsunami, if you will, of anti-Semitism, that meanwhile has not only escalated with hundreds of percentages rise of attacks of Jews and Jewish institutions, including in Australia, but in fact in what I would regard as the normalization of anti-Semitism. That, for me, is a very dangerous moment. The understanding, and just this morning, some of us may have witnessed or watched what happened in the subway in New York City, what we see in the streets of Montreal, where I grew up, where a father is beaten up to a pulp in front of his children who are hiding, and nobody does anything in the moments, long moments of this video until the perpetrator actually not only finishes assaulting him and throws his kippah, but is then released by a judge, quoting a criminologist that it was a very hot day in Montreal. The normalization that we see in the recent letter signed by what's called cultural figures, more than 200 of them, including many artists, including many across the pop culture of our times, signing a petition to release Barghouti, serving 5 life sentences for the murder of and perpetration of and planning of genocidal terror attacks. So I think that what we are missing is, first of all, the urgency, which you can hear in my voice, I think is rising. And secondly, the connecting of dots with a comprehensive strategy. You asked me what each of those countries can and must do. I include the State of Israel in that. And that is actually what, alongside about 35 special envoys for combating anti-Semitism in July of 2024 in Argentina, marking 30 years to the Amia bombing, we all signed, actually committing our governments to create what we called national strategies that recommit to the International Holocaust remembrance definition of anti-Semitism, the only definition, the result of a long democratic process that enables to identify what it is that everybody seems to be committed to combating, including the modern mutated strain that denies Israel's very right to exist, the demonization, the delegitimization, and the double standards that are in that IRA working definition. These national strategies had to not only be rolled out, obviously created with the support of each of the governments, but need to be implemented. Australia itself, my counterpart in Australia, Gillian Siegel, rolled out a national strategy with a prime minister standing beside her. But it's not enough to roll out a national strategy if you're not going to implement it across spaces and places. And I'll add, Israel too, I was the signatory, committed to creating a national strategy for combating anti-Semitism. And in Israel's case, as the nation state of the Jewish people, it need be an international strategy for combating anti-Semitism that holds our counterparts and other governments to account if they fail not only to roll out these strategies, but to implement them across spaces and places, predicting and preventing the attacks that we saw, not just condemning them after the fact.
Let's talk a bit about what Israel does and doesn't do when it comes to anti-Semitism. I think, after the terrorist attack in Australia, there's been a lot of talk about Israel warning Australia. I think Israel and, you know, Australian police and intelligence didn't know specifically what the attack would be, right? But Israel had sent a lot of warnings about anti-Semitism possibly becoming violent. Could you explain to us in broader terms how Israel operates when it, you know, receives intelligence or learns that there's a specific threat or even a broader threat, right? And this wasn't such a specific warning in Australia. And is Australia unique in its response? I mean, Israel views Australia as basically disregarding their warnings. Was that something unique? Like in your experience as the envoy, what were the sorts of responses you saw usually when Israel was giving a direct warning?
So first of all, I'll say, and I've met with, you know, sort of security chiefs of police, including in Australia, actually, the outgoing and the incoming chief of police in Canberra, are well aware of something that I believe has to be made very, very clear. In the words of the late Rabbi Sacks, anti-Semitism is the most reliable sign of a major threat to humanity and freedom and the dignity of difference. That means that actually law enforcement mechanisms very often are aware that anti-Semitism is signaling, if you will, alerting to something that is much, much bigger than only, though it should be enough, the Jews, the visible Jews, or the Zionists, by the way, because you need not be a Jew to be the target of this modern mutated strain of anti-Semitism. You need just identify as, or be self-identify as, or be identified as a Zionist who believes in Israel's right to exist or supports it in any ways. The importance of the collaboration of the security industries, we'll call them, including the warning that, you know, may have been heeded, that may have been given. And by the way, of course, Australia is not alone. We know that the UK, we know that Canada, we know that transnational aggression of the very same genocidal terror organizations that attacked Israel until, on, and since October the 7th, by the way, the criminal Islamic regime in Iran, Qatar, Turkey, funding genocidal terror proxies, what they actually are able to predict is extremism, right? Wherever I go, I try and make accessible. It matters not if it comes from what we call the extreme right, the extreme left, or the extreme Islamist, key word being extreme. The thing with anti-Semitism, this ever-mutating lethal hate that's been around for thousands of years, that mutates by latching on to the guiding social construct of each time, in our time being human rights and this understanding of what international law is supposed to mean, is that it actually can predict what threatens those societies. And I actually am deeply worried by the growing gap between the security industry's understanding in many of those countries, including those that we mentioned. I know some of them very well in Canada and Australia, as I said, and have met with them. And actually, their understanding is very different than the understanding of elected officials, of lawmakers, of politicians. I think that is something that is inherently dangerous to democracies and that actually represents something about the lack of understanding or the lack of wanting to understand what it is that threatens the foundations of democracies. More specifically to the role of Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, as there is no holistic strategy that actually includes a conversation that should be mandatory, interministerial, intergovernment, security industry, and actually with civil society organizations. That is what I would expect of a holistic strategy. That is what I would expect of some of the recommendations, including those that I submitted to three foreign ministers in the time of my 2+ year voluntary role as Israel's special envoy. The understanding that there needs to be some sort of then an authority, I'll call it, because it seems that there is no collaboration, means that, for example, as Israel's special envoy, I wasn't privy to the conversations that were being had. In fact, as a former lawmaker, I'll tell you, these are conversations that need to be had in Knesset as well, right? We have a Security and Foreign Affairs Committee that actually has oversight responsibility to the executive branch. Once again, if this is a manifestation, anti-Semitism, is a manifestation of this raging eighth front that is existential for the state of Israel and actually sounds the alarms for national security threats to all of the countries in which it is on the rise or it is normalized, then we need to be treating it as we would any other war front. It is, in many ways, I always begin, as you may know, with a 50-year-long war. The opening shot of this unconventional war for public opinion began, from my perspective, 50 years ago in the 1975 Zionism as Racism resolution. I don't want to drill down too much in that, but the understanding that if Zionism is racism, and then post-Durban 2001, Israel's an apartheid state, and then in the most dangerous Orwellian inversion of fact and law, Israel is accused of perpetrating genocide post the October 7 massacre, in 2023, seated on the docket of the accused, if you will, in the International Court of Justice, accused by none other than South Africa of none other than the crime of genocide that was a word, but also a convention coined by Raphael Lemkin to describe the atrocities of the Holocaust. What we see here is much, much deeper. It is a war front. It needs to be treated as a war front. And in no other war front would we say we have no strategy. We are just responding. We are just reacting. And so just to segue back to your question, devastatingly, as Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, different from many of my counterparts in the rest of the world, in the US, in Canada, in many other places in Europe, I was not privy to the conversations that the security industry and organizations are having. And I would say that's actually another testament to the lack of understanding of how severe an existential threat anti-Semitism is, both as symptom and as weapon in this eighth front, as I call it, of a raging war.
Going back to the strategy, which you talked about each country committing to developing, and obviously each country is unique, but let's take, say, the West broadly conceived and Israel separately. For each of those, if you were advising, or you were advising, but as today, if you were advising the government of Australia, the government of the United States, and the government of Israel, what would be the three most important actionable elements in such a strategy from your perspective?
Well, it's not because I'm a lawyer, but as you know, every law begins with definitions, and there's a reason for that. So you cannot identify something without defining it, and you certainly can't combat what you can't identify. And I say that because the first and most important advice that I've given to governments around the world, to lawmakers, including our own, is to begin reinforcing and making clear that the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, the result of a long democratic process, is the definition of anti-Semitism. It means that when we see these responses, as we have seen post the bloodbath on Bondi Beach, when we see the responses that say there is no room for anti-Semitism in wherever, New York City, Sydney, Montreal, the question that beckons, and I ask some mayors and some lawmakers this, that's very good. That's very important that there's no room for anti-Semitism. What is anti-Semitism? And if you don't know to be able to respond to that question, what is anti-Semitism? And as I said, using the IRA working definition, you are not committed to combating all forms, all strains, if you will, of what is an ever-mutating lethal hate. The 11 examples integral to the IRA working definition, and I always point out the three Ds, Natan Sharansky's three Ds, demonization, delegitimization, and double standards, because they are the mechanism that enable anti-Semitism to mutate, if you will. It's not just the what happened, but the how it happens. If a government, a city, an institution, a university, I met with tens of university presidents before and since October the 7th. If you do not know to identify something comprehensively, you're not actually going to be able to combat it. And that definition is the first and most important statement that needs to be made by any, as I said, government, official, leader that is stating their commitment to combating anti-Semitism. That's the first thing. The second thing is, of course, implementing your own policies, your own laws, the understanding that what we've seen in the better part of the past 2 years is complete impunity for the violation of what we've seen across the world, vitriol, vandalism, violence, that in any other context, to quote the university presidents at their hearing in Congress, would actually be considered a violation of law, holding to account those that are violating the law. The understanding that there is, and that's why double standards are so important, that there is this inherent double standard to the way that anti-Semitism is treated around the world, in particular in its modern mutated strain of anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism is not a legitimate political view. Anti-Zionism is racism. It's anti-Zionism that is that modern strain of an ever-mutating lethal hate. And so the second piece is actually to implement existing laws, policies, guidelines. This is true for social media as well. The understanding that there are community guidelines that protects identities, except, oh, that Zionist identity, except that the majority of Jews and many non-Jews around the world self-identify as Zionists. I can't just shed my Zionist pound of flesh to be a good human being. And online, too, it is legitimate to say whatever you want for a long time. Of course, in response to these massacres, we see an uptick in what's legitimate to say. and the enforcement of those guidelines, policies, laws, regulations has been completely missing. So not just words, not just condemnation.
Can you give an example of a policy that exists, it's on the books, but has been ignored in the context of anti-Semitism?
Well, first of all, we've seen the literal conduct, not speech, including on university campuses across Canada and the United States, conduct, harassment, bullying, the prevention of access to classroom. We've seen actual violence in these protests. I'll share with you because you want an anecdote. I was at U of T on one of my emergency trips. I was in Canada. I was at U of T where there was a protest outside of the president's office using megaphones. Only that the university policy stipulate no megaphones can be used in any outdoor protest that the students are holding. There are basic policies, and that's a really minimal one. We're talking about much worse offenses. I've mentioned some of them. The aftermath of that attack of the father in Montreal, where the judge quotes a criminologist that says it was a hot day in Montreal. The aftermath of Sarah Halimi's murder, that the judge actually says that the perpetrator, the murderer, was high on drugs. The aftermath of event after event where we see that there is this double standard in the application of law is what enables, fuels extremism. And finally, it is, and perhaps the most difficult thing to make accessible, and what I try to with myself actually wonder how it is that I make accessible to non-Jews around the world. Anti-Semitism is not the problem of Jews. We would never ever say that any form of such a lethal hate is the problem of the subject or the target of that hate. Anti-Semitism is the problem of anti-Semites and of the places and spaces that allow them to spread, to fester, to actually be emboldened by the silence, by the denial, by the justification. I'll never forget Judith Butler, who I studied in law school, explaining that rape was armed resistance. A radical feminist explaining that is not just a problem for Jewish women. That is not just a problem for women at all. The understanding that anti-Semitism is never, ever going to be able to be, I'm not going to say completely obliterated because I would be completely naive to say that. As I said, it's existed for thousands of years. But anti-Semitism has become popular. It has become acceptable. And if we don't, as number three on that list of things that must be done, if we don't make clear that the imperative is to make anti-Semitism unacceptable, and for that, not just Jews and not just Zionists need to be alarmed, but all who cherish our shared foundational values of life and of liberty, of the countries in which anti-Semitism has become normalized, sounding those sirens, whether it be Australia or Canada or the United States or France or the UK or Germany, the understanding that what this calls for is the sense of urgency that you could probably hear it in my voice, that far, far transcends real or perceived differences of politics, of religion, of geography, of denomination, to understand that what we're looking at, the writing on the wall, is not just the writing on Bondi Beach, it's not just the writing in Montreal, it's not just the writing in Manchester in a synagogue that was attacked, it's not just the writing that murdered Yaron and Sarah, two diplomats of a country. If any other country's diplomats would have been murdered on the front steps of the Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C., at the end of an event, a Jewish organization discussing peaceful paths forward, the world would have been shaking. But the world basically had a blip in the aftermath of Yaron and Sarah's murder in the news and in the way that it was covered. So accountability will have to be across the board, and the understanding of this urgency needs to be made accessible, including by us as the State of Israel, across differences.
Over the weekend, there was a report in Ynet, Yediot, that the Prime Minister's office is starting to think that maybe state actors are behind the spread of anti-Semitism, which to me was like, good morning. You know, have you seen Al Jazeera in the past 30 years? They certainly did not take the urgency seriously if they're just waking up now. But now that they do seem to be waking up to this, what can be done to push back against, you know, state actors and especially state actors, right? If it's the Qataris, maybe Turkey, you know, that seem to have curried a lot of favor with the U.S. government.
for me, this is a devastating piece. You know, as you may remember, I was, you know, in the sort of forefront of the legal demand for the return of Hadar Golden for the past 11 years and 3 months. Just a couple of days ago, we marked his Shloshim. He was returned to burial just, as I said, 30 years plus a few, 30 days plus a few more days ago, after 11 years and 3 months of what was a standing violation of agreement, of law, of morality. And again, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Ron Gvili continues to be held in the same standing violation of another internationally brokered agreement that is actually being violated with every day that passes when Ron is not returned for burial as well. What I want to say about the state actors, and I think, you know, the U.S. at the time, and my first emergency trip, I had met with the previous administration's special envoy for the issue of the hostages and gave him the entire, all of the materials that we created for that legal case and cause, because the demand should and could have been, as we well know, of Qatar on October the 8th to return 251 human beings with the demand of let our people go. Then that sort of translation into what is an Orwellian inverted reality in which Qatar is cast as honest broker, not only for the return of our hostages abducted on October the 7th, but as you said, as the state sponsor of terrorism that has actually bought up the West, recognizing that democracies are for sale, that has bought up universities, as we know, trillions of dollars pouring into American universities, that has actually peddled its anti-Semitic propaganda, utilizing the Al Jazeera. And again, we would be remiss if we don't connect the dots. The Al Jazeera that then produced those grotesque ceremonies in which our hostages were released. The understanding that this, again, brings me back to that warning of the late Rabbi Sacks, that anti-Semitism is the most reliable sign of a major threat to humanity, freedom, and the dignity of difference. What starts with us never, ever ends with us. And if in this constellation, us is the Jew among nations, that is the state of Israel, there is a devastating state of affairs if we can't make accessible to democracies, thriving democracies, that it is their foundations that are at risk. There is more and more of an understanding, and as you said, yeah, about time that the state of Israel too realizes that, especially in an online reality, there is such an easy ability to actually access millions with these propaganda libelous campaigns, as we've seen. You know, it's not just Qatar, and it's not just the Islamic regime in Iran. I don't know if you remember, but a few weeks after the October 7 massacre, Bin Laden's letter to America resurfaced on TikTok with millions of Gen Zers saying, "Oh, Bin Laden was right." Meaning, at the time, what I tried to make accessible, including to my counterpart in the United States, Deborah Lipstadt, and we did hold a discussion with the social media platforms that sort of attempted to follow up on the hearings we had held that I began in Knesset, and then we're in Congress, and then we're in the European Parliament, because what this predicts is a national security threat to each of those countries. The understanding that foreign countries are meddling in any way possible in what is happening in this war for public opinion internally and are actually collapsing the foundations of democracies from within is something that I think this once again is just another example of, another manifestation of, if you will, that enables us, and I'll say demands, that we sound the sirens and make this accessible, not only collecting the evidence vis-a-vis anti-Semitism, but with anti-Semitism as a predictor, there is what binds together, what unites, as I said, the extremists on all sides, whatever we may call them, including in this case, Muslim Brotherhood extremist, Qatar and others, Turkey and others, is anti-Semitism. It sells, it works. And so anti-Semitism can become a tool in which we are able to identify that extremism and make accessible to our counterparts around the world, not just in the security industry, but to governments around the world, what the urgency of the matter looks like. I devastatingly say that it's, as you said, Lahav, a sort of a very delayed response to what we've known for a long time. And we know that the transnational aggression, from my perspective, in a very personal way around the world, Canada included, the transnational aggression of the criminal Islamic regime in Iran that targets individuals, some of whom we know very well, in other spaces, whether it's in the UK or Canada or Sydney, Australia, that was already one, at least, such attack thwarted. That understanding is extremely alarming, and it's about time that Israel actually recognizes it too.
Michal, listening to you today and in general, really the sense of urgency and also the comprehensive, holistic nature of the threat comes through. And I found myself asking, as somebody who grew up in New York and who didn't experience anti-Semitism in a very minor way growing up, what does the future hold? You know, is the genie already out of the bottle? You have anti-Semitism on the left and on the right and from Islamist extremists and from other kinds of extremism. And it seems like, you know, and maybe this is a little bit depressing, but this may be the reality, it's only going to get worse. You know, it's becoming normalized, and social media is allowing the worst to come to the surface. And you have, in some cases, growing populations of immigrants from certain countries that bring highly anti-Semitic attitudes with them. What do you think is the future for Jewish communities abroad, you know, for the 10 years, 15 years, 20 years down the road? Here in Israel, there's sort of two schools of thought. One school of thought is, well, Israel has responsibility to do whatever it can to strengthen and preserve and help those communities grow and thrive. Another school of thought says, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years down the road, those Jews are going to either basically have a choice between either assimilating and hiding any Jewish identity or symbols, or moving to the state of Israel. So when you look at communities, the United States being the largest, but the UK, Australia, Canada, France, Argentina, Jewish communities around the world, what do you see as their future 10 years, 20 years down the road?
Look, I think that's very much up to us, Asher. I actually take a great deal of inspiration from our own history, right? I think of that last time about 2,500 years ago or so in ancient Persia, when there was an attempt to commit genocide of the Jewish people, our people. And I remember very well what Mordechai said to Esther, right? He said to her, if you will be silent now, salvation will come to our people and you and your father's home will disappear. And who knows if it's not for this moment you've arrived. And I also remember what it is that Esther says to Mordechai, which is gather all the Jews, which is the understanding for me that we are facing this as a people. We are, whether we live in Israel, Australia, Canada, or any of the countries you mentioned, we are facing this as a people. The understanding that united, and that's not uniformity, but united on this, on these issues, on actually utilizing the IHRA working definition to say anti-Zionism is the modern strain of anti-Semitism. It's not enough that you tell me you're committed to protecting Jewish life in New York City or Montreal or Berlin if you don't recognize anti-Zionism, that is, the systematic demonization, delegitimization, and application of double standards to the state of Israel as Jew among nations, then you are not committed to combating anti-Semitism in any of those spaces. Where I actually draw a great deal of optimism is not only from our past, knowing that here we are sitting and talking about this, but it is that we're doing so with the three of us seated in Israel, the nation state to which our people returned, an indigenous people returned after thousands of years of exile and persecution that is committed to equality. That's not me. That's Israel's Declaration of Independence, with a little more than half of us here and a little less than half of us in the rest of the world. It is with the understanding that we have never had the capability of what the late Rabbi Soloveitchik referred to as the covenant of destiny, of leaning into this moment, not fleeing from, not checking who will hide us in their attic, but leaning into this moment and actually, because a state of Israel exists, supposed to be an equal member in the family of nations, a place in which we can defend ourselves, in which never again for us means never again are we going to wait for somebody to come and save us. Because Israel exists, and a little more than half of us are here, and a little less than half of us are in the rest of the world, we can stand up tall. As actually a cousin of mine sent me a video from this morning in Sydney where they prayed on the same spot in Bondi Beach where the bloodbath took place, prayed Shacharit together. The understanding that we stand up tall and lean into our identity and live rich Jewish lives and actually make accessible to the places and spaces that we inhabit in those countries around the world. Because it's not even just allies and friends. Because what we're trying to make accessible is, this is not just about us. We may be the bloody canary in a coal mine, but what is coming next impacts you. And that responsibility is one that I think we can carry out in a way that we could not have dreamt about, or our aunts or grandparents could not have dreamt about. You don't have to go very far back in time. And where you began your question, you know, I often say I'm a little bit older than both of you. I often say to my counterparts, and I know you experienced it too, we thought we were living the new normal. I grew up in Canada, you in New York City, Lahav also in the States. We thought we were living some sort of new normal. But the truth is that we lived the anomaly of Jewish history. This is the normal. And we have, just as our enemies have a playbill of how it is that anti-Semitism works to bind them together, we also have the sort of manual of what we need to do. And the fact that the state of Israel exists, from my perspective, is what requires greater action, greater courage, if you will, at leaning in and recognizing that that is not just the resilience, but the hope that carried our people for thousands of years, that Hanukkah represents, and the hope that will carry us for thousands of more if we lean into this moment in that understanding that we face this as a people, that we have a role and responsibility to play, and that we actually take very clear action with courage to call out and expect of leadership across spaces, geography, politics, religion, to make what it is that needs to be very accessible to the wider public. And that is, as I said before, that anti-Semitism is not the problem of Jews. It's the problem of anti-Semites and of the places and spaces that allow them to infect, to spread, to fester. And I'll say just one last thing on that, because you asked in your question, I always say, this is not about immigration. We were all actually, our grandparents, our great-grandparents were all immigrants. It's not about immigration. It's about lack of integration. It's about the lack of democracies, of countries in the West, creating a very clear understanding of what the set of values are, if you will, that when you're integrated into a country that you are welcomed into, what those shared foundational principles are, and they cannot, absolutely cannot, be principles that accept this ever-mutating lethal hate as a part of what is allowed to thrive, as a part of what is allowed to spread with this kind of impunity, as we've seen across the West.
So I want to ask you about the topic of international law, since you're also the head of the International Legal Forum. We see a lot of examples of international law sort of being weaponized against Israel, being twisted. I'm sure you're familiar, but it might be somewhat obscure to our listeners with this new bill in South Africa, for example, that apartheid is considered by the UN to be a crime against humanity. And South Africa has decided to enforce a law. Well, they haven't decided yet. It's a bill, but it seems to have a lot of support to enforce the law against apartheid, right? Or enforce the fact that it's a crime against humanity by saying that anyone seen to support apartheid can be prosecuted. And supporting apartheid means supporting Israel. This, of course, puts all supporters of Israel and most of the Jewish community in South Africa in danger. So when we talk about this sort of perversion of international law, a lot of times we're talking about the warrant against Netanyahu, but it's really hitting home for a major Jewish community. Do you think international law is something that can be saved, or at this point it's just become just so twisted?
First of all, a part of the reason that I accepted to step into the role of CEO of the International Legal Forum is precisely in order to make accessible the imperative to reclaim international law. The understanding that I referred to before, anti-Semitism is a manifestation and a weapon in this unconventional war for public opinion. But the root, if you will, is actually the systematic hijacking and redefinition and inversion and weaponization of international law, of the human rights infrastructure created around it to uphold, promote, and protect, if you will, of the post-World War II international rules-based order, that the institutions that have been hijacked systematically were actually entrusted to uphold, promote, and protect equally and consistently, so that never again. The understanding that once again, and all of the examples that you mentioned are so important, love, because they are each examples of what it is that I mean when I say the systematic hijacking, redefinition, inversion, and weaponization. And we can now begin to go through all of those. I always point as the three sort of milestone moments, if you will, that got us to where we are. But I said before, the 1975 Zionism is Racism resolution. If you watch Daniel Patrick Moynihan's, the then U.S. ambassador to the U.N. speech in 1975, what he understands is this moment in time as the collapse of that international institution that was entrusted, created and entrusted to uphold, promote, and protect. Why? And he says so there, right? And he says, Zionism may be a lot of things, but it isn't and cannot be racism. What does, when we talk about the brown, red, green alliance, right? The Nazi ideology, I'll call it for lack of a better word, the Soviet propaganda, you know, sort of protocols of the elders of Zion, and the green, the Islamist, jihadist ideologies. The brown, red, green alliance didn't start today. Zionism is racism, adopts Nazi ideology, that actually has the Jews as a race. We are not a race, and an inferior one at that, of course, because the guiding social construct of that time was science. That's what Nazis, after the guiding social construct of religion, was the guiding social construct that enabled anti-Semitism to thrive. The Nazis actually took science, the guiding social construct of the time, to legitimize, if you will, and normalize the murder of Jews, to actually justify the eradication of an inferior race. So Zionism as racism adopts that. It adopts good old Soviet propaganda, right? The protocols of the elders of Zion, of Zionism as racism, into a UN institution passed by the support of the then Arab League that refuses to accept the existence of a Jew among the map of the Middle East, anywhere, in any border. That understanding is what we're seeing today. And if you ask me that extremely important question, love, it is exactly what it is that needs to be understood and actually used to make accessible why this is not a problem just for Jews or just for the state of Israel, that Jew among nations in this context. It is a problem for all who thought that those foundational principles were created and entrusted to uphold that pledge of never again, and to uphold some sort of an international rules-based order that enables Western societies, democracies, and I'll say, all countries that cherish life and liberty. Look, we're in a post-Abraham Accords era. Those countries made the choice of, at the time, I called it the paradigmal shift. I think I've spoken to you about it, Lahav, from the three no's of Khartoum, more or less at the same time as Zionism as racism passes in the UN, are the three no's of Khartoum, right? Where are they? No to recognition, no to negotiation, no to peace with Israel, to the three yeses, to recognition, that enables negotiation, that paves the path to peace. If at the time I wrote an article published, I think in Newsweek, called The War on the Abraham Accords, when we signed those Abraham Accords and I was a member in Knesset, we would be remiss if we didn't understand that that's what this moment represents. But again, with us just on the front lines, us being the state of Israel, us being Jews around the world, or Zionists that believe in Israel's right to exist, with us on the front lines of what is an axis of evil very clearly bound together by these ideology of which anti-Semitism is the great glue, that has actually openly declared intent to destroy and build on the rubble of our civilization an alternate reality. You mentioned some of those, Turkey, the criminal Islamic regime in Iran, China, and others are collaborating very clearly, utilizing anti-Semitism as this tool, but literally not, singularly not. And if we don't understand that this is the moment to lean in, for all of us who understand that without an international rules-based order, without rules that are equally and consistently applied, it's not because I'm a lawyer. I always say the understanding that rules are made to be applied equally and consistently. If I say to a three-year-old, we're going to play a game, you'll play according to the rules, and I will not, a three-year-old will understand that they are not playing. The understanding that the redefinition, we can go through the terms, right? Zionism is racism. Israel's an apartheid state post the 2001 UN Durban against racism, as we said. So it's interesting, isn't it, that South Africa is the one that seated Israel at the ICJ, the ICC, which we just in these days we can discuss at more length. But the continued actual abuse of these courts of last resort, that's what they were meant to be. They also have principles, complementarity, and all kinds of others that have been completely ignored. That understanding has to be made accessible, because if there are no rules, there are no laws governing the way that we coexist, then societal covenant breaks. That means that there are no principles, shared principles that protect anyone. And that for me is actually a big part of ILF's role and ability to as I said before, transcend and reach across real or perceived differences of geography, of religion, of politics. The law is not to be politicized. When the law is politicized to suit somebody, a side, then it actually becomes a very dangerous tool, as we have seen, that can justify, if you will, precisely the kinds of attacks we saw in Bondi. So, is it redeemable? I sure am not going to go down without trying, reminding myself, you know, not only the urgency, but if I'll be silent now, then who knows what it is that can be done. I know that our people will survive, but I, in many ways, think that that is the least that we can do. And there are, in many ways, individuals around the world, not just lawyers. You don't need to be a lawyer. I'll give an example. John Spencer, who's an urban war strategist, understands plenty well that if the laws of war can be applied selectively, or as he says, not just double standards, but invented standards, then democracies are not going to be able to fight wars against genocidal terror proxies of regimes, tyrannical, totalitarian regimes that openly declare the intent to destroy them, right? And so the understanding actually really can be made accessible across the very many differences that we may have. And I think that the law is a very critical piece of that.
Michal Cutler-Wunsch, CEO of the International Legal Forum and Israel's former special envoy for anti-Semitism, for combating anti-Semitism. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, to both of you. And Chag Sameach, with a reminder of the resilience and the courage.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav on social media. And go to www.misgavins.org for more updates. You can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to Mideast Horizons Podcast at gmail.com. And we'll see you next week.